This is the bottom line. I'm Doug Wells. Employment in rural Utah communities has been in decline for several years. Areas like Carbon, Emery, Duchesne, Uinta, and Wayne counties have traditionally depended on coal or oil and gas jobs. During boom times, jobs are plentiful. But when the busts inevitably occur, the jobs disappear and the local communities are left struggling to make ends meet. How can rural Utah towns diversify and find ways to avoid keeping all of their eggs in these fossil fuel baskets? What's new and different from an economic development standpoint that are on the horizon for these counties? Our guests today are Joel McKay Smith. He is the co-founder and CEO of Accelerant BSP. We also have Ben Hart. He is the deputy director of the Governor's Office of Economic Development. Gentlemen, thank you for joining us on The Bottom Line.
Thank you.
Thanks, Doug.
So let's start with some statistics just to get a feel of where rural Utah is today. So unemployment in the state of Utah is one of the lowest in the nation. We're very fortunate to have a very strong job market. But what's it like in rural Utah? What's the percent employment and some idea of average household income?
Well, it differs all over the state, and whether you're in northern Utah in places like Cache and Box Elder, or you're in very rural Utah like Duchesne and Emery and Uinta, each one of those economies is going to look drastically different. In the energy hit eastern part of the state, you're seeing much bigger unemployment rates. At times, it's fluctuated even as high as double digits, which is unheard of along the Wasatch Front, where we're prospering at 3.1 or 3.2. But then average household income has also declined as well. So it really does depend on which state or which part of the state you're looking at. And I think what you do to address that also depends on the resources available there at the local level.
So, Ben, let's stay with you for a while, because, Joel, your company is really working on solutions. And I want to stay on where we are right now. So in the open, I mentioned these rural counties tend to be very fossil fuel dependent. Is that accurate? And is there that disparity that you mentioned between northern Utah and southern Utah as well?
Yeah, there is differences in every part of the state. But I mean, the energy, the coal producing counties like Carbon has experienced some pretty dramatic job decreases. Uinta was down 8.2% last year in 2016. Wayne was down 4.6%. And again, where we're talking about Silicon Slopes at being 6.5% growth, you know, in the last couple of years, that it is definitely disparate. I think that's probably the right word to use. But when we talk about what can we do to help those counties, there's a lot of things that are out there. But we have to realize what's there, what's happening on the ground before we can really start to do anything meaningful to help those communities.
Okay. Let's stay there one minute longer, then Joel, I'm going to get to you. What needs to be put in place in order to help these counties diversify their economy and succeed on several fronts and diversify away from fossil fuels?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, and part of this is culture, too. I mean, when you're so ingrained with this is what energy or oil production is, and you have whole communities that are sort of designed around that, trying to help people understand that diversification is a good thing, that's sort of your first battle. I mean, helping people understand that, you know, there are IT opportunities, there's call center opportunities, there's aerospace opportunities. There are ways to plug into the growth along the Wasatch Front to really help your economy grow. So first, it's got to be a culture and a paradigm shift to understand that it's okay to diversify. And then from there, I think it's making connections. And I think that's what Joel has done so well with at Accelerant. But ultimately, we've got to get, as the governor says, it's a simple math problem. Here along the Wasatch Front, we don't have enough workers. In rural Utah, we have an excess labor force. How do we bring those two things together? And I think you need a good convener, and I think that's where we see innovative solutions happening.
Well, and Joel, your company, Accelerant BSP, is working on that. Tell us what you guys do.
Certainly. Accelerant has been kind of a nexus of about a 15-year relationship that started in Bentonville, Arkansas, with the launch of a consumer product called Community Wireless. My partner and I were making repeated trips back and forth across the U.S., and we would always stop in these small towns, and there was always a common element of kind of a withering Main Street, but really good people that wanted to stay there. My partner, Dean Lundberg, he had established a number of different fixed wireless companies that he had bought and sold over the last few years, with the last acquisition being Vivint Wireless. He sold his company to Vivint, and in the meantime, I was working on a number of different rural opportunities in all places of the Arizona Strip. We established a call center with wireless internet service provider in Hilldale, Colorado City, and Centennial, which is now known as Plus One Company, which is a major employer in Kane County.
Okay. And the governor says simple math, right? We've got a shortage of people here in Salt Lake and Utah County, shortage of knowledge workers. And we have high unemployment in these rural areas. Is it as simple as that, Joel?
It is to an extent of the math, but the extent of the skill up and being able to pair the community with the company is a little bit more difficult. We kind of hit the ball out of the park with our first partnership with GoEd with Health Equity as an example. We were able to identify a core group of already pre-trained individuals working out of Carbon County that had already been trained in high achievement type of call center type of work, financial services, transcription, translation, and those type of things, as well as a populace that about 1,000 cars a day travel from Carbon and Emery County to the Wasatch Front for work. So Health Equity had a need, as they are a company that has the transition of what you would have the seasonal needs. They needed to be able to tap into something that doesn't currently exist on the Wasatch Front, which is a surplus of well-spoken, trainable, and in this case, financial services for a health services agency company. We were able to align with Steve Nilleman. Congratulations with having him come onto the board.
That was exciting.
GoEd, which is fantastic. Awesome, awesome guy. As well as a number of other key principals down there, like Tammy Ursenbach, as well as Jake Miller and Jay, I can't remember Jay's last name. But we were able to, in a cooperative way, attack a problem and address it. And what was going to be a 15-person trial built out to a total hire of about 67 people with an attrit of less than 5% in the time period. And they're now all working with full benefits.
Great. No, that's a nice success story. Yeah. Ben, you mentioned something earlier that, you know, it is numbers related, but it's also helping people understand the need to diversify. Is that just with the general population, or is that also with their business leaders, the mayors, their legislatures? Do they get the need to diversify?
Yeah, it's both. It's all of the above for sure. I think there has to be an education of what different industries can really come in and play a role in these local communities. I think Joel expressed that very well. Last October, for example, we took some of the largest aerospace companies in the world, Lockheed Martin, L3 Communications, and others, and we did basically a four-county tour where we realized that there's a lot of displaced workers who have transferable skills that would be very likely to pick up contracts for aerospace companies. And so, but as we got out, we realized there was going to be that little bit of that give and take from what they're used to and familiar with in energy, and transferring that to something that was, you know, very lucrative in terms of aerospace contracting as well. And so we had to do a lot of educating. They picked it up really quick, and we're working with several companies out in the area that want to be aerospace contractors. But it's an education that I think you have to do very delicately, because they want to do what they're familiar with, but when that's not always available, we have to present other opportunities.
Well, there's the education for their mindset, and then there's also the education to transfer the industries. Take us inside of the tent a little bit. When you have somebody that's been an energy worker, which is fairly technologically complex as well, mm-hmm. so is aerospace. So they have the capabilities to do this technological work, but they don't have the specific skills. They transfer, but they don't have those specific skills. How do they get trained in those new skills?
Well, training is a key part of our efforts all across the state. I mean, workforce is the number one concern, whether you're in rural Utah or urban. And so training and getting people the skills they need to be successful, I think, has to be part of any economic development plan. It can't just be about, hey, let's recruit new businesses. You have to line up with what the demand is. And so training, and particularly when you get inside the head of someone, is they're saying, I've been in the energy industry for 15 years. Do I really want to go back to school and retrain and skill up so that I can be relevant in another industry, even if that training can be minimal? I think for every person, the thought of, hey, my skills are no longer relevant in the economy, and I've got to look at doing something to make myself more relevant, can be a scary conversation, without question. But, you know, when you go step inside a machining shop that contracts for the energy industry, and then you look at what the machine shop that looks like for the aerospace industry, they're not that different. I mean, there's a similarity there. So I think in terms of helping people take that step, it really is visually, whatever you can do to help them understand, it's not that much different. You know, a little bit of retraining may be needed, but you can be just as effective and relevant as you were.
And if I could add to that too, Duncan Aviation's a great example of how we might be able to do something along these lines. They're going from, I think it's about 15, 20,000 square feet to 300,000 square feet. And in the next 24 months, they're going to need to upskill and hire between 250 to 300 people.
And if I'm not mistaken, Duncan Aviation does retrofits for corporate jets.
That's correct.
Primarily based, I think of them as Provo Airport. Are they in other airports as well?
But because of the issue with the workforce and the urban problem of not enough workforce, they're right now looking at ways to work with the ATCs in Carbon County, Juab County, and even Millard County to be able to uptrain them now on the same type of skills that you would do for automotive repair and upholstery work and everything like that, because it's not going to be that much of a drive to even get some sort of ride sharing going on from those areas so that they can have a populace that is ready to be able to accommodate that to complement what they already have in, like, Southern Utah County with an employment need. There's already that proactive approach by the Division of Workforce Services and the LDS's Self-Reliance Department, which is wonderful.
So are those the types of jobs that people from these other counties are going to have to commute towards, or is Duncan Aviation setting up smaller shops in these rural counties?
Those are more of a commute example. But there are a lot of other fabrication type of opportunities. Brian Sather, who I think you know from Blacksmith International, if you don't, he's a great guy up in Park City, has about 50 to 75 companies that he currently sources to India and Chinese factories that he has. He's looking into the possibility of bringing those jobs to rural Utah, training on AutoCAD for, like, the cutters and everything else like that, and having more of a just-in-time approach to some of the things that they're doing with textiles and everything else. It's a complete game changer if it works. That would be in one of the rural communities. It would be done in a way that you've typically been sourcing because of the convenience of expense within China, or as an example. He'd maintain his factories over there, but the just-in-time part of what you could do for assembly, for, like, outdoor and stuff like that, could be something we could put in Emory County or Carbon County, or for that matter, Kane County, which has a great example of already doing some textile and outdoor work.
So when you guys are talking to business leaders in the state, I suspect, you know, most business leaders' hearts are in the right place. They'd love to outsource to Southern Utah as opposed to Southern China. But I think Apple's a great case where, you know, I believe President Obama asked Tim Cook, hey, what's it going to take to get some of these manufacturing jobs back? And Tim Cook was very blunt and said, you know, it's just not going to happen. Mm-hmm. What's your experience like as you're talking to these business owners in Utah?
You know, as we have this conversation with business owners in Utah, it's a much different scenario. We can make dollar and cents cases and justifications, which I think in some of these larger scale manufacturing operations, you just can't. It's not going to make sense dollars and cents wise. But for some of our Utah businesses to say, hey, if you can take some of your operations, or if you can take some of your part of your facility and outsource this to rural Utah, it's not nearly as cost prohibitive as it would be in other cases. And so when we bring this idea up, this rural outsourcing idea, it really, I think we probably get more traction than what President Obama got. And so I think it is something that makes sense. We're doing more and more of it. I think we're going to do some more public things with this as well in the next 2 to 3 months. And we want to see more of this happening. So,
and let's talk about the social costs of society as jobs leave and the social costs of unemployment. You know, there's the dollars and cents for the company, but then there's also the dollars and cents for the state and the county that has to provide services when people are unemployed. What do some of these harder hit areas look like? Are we seeing increases in drug abuse and other social issues?
Well, it's interesting. The social cost is real, and it's there when the economy is good and when the economy is bad. What we've seen in some parts of the state is that a very healthy economy, when there are high wages, it fuels some of the same problems that you see in a bad economy. And so the social cost is real. Definitely the cost has decreased as the employment has as the economy has improved, but it's a heavy cost to the state without question. So if there are preventative things that we can do on the front end, it makes all the sense in the world. We saw this with the transitional housing here along the Wasatch Front, with our housing and community development, and reducing homelessness. And so, yeah, the good economy, it really does help, but the cost is tremendous, and prevention is worth its weight in gold.
Yeah. If you're just joining us this morning, we're discussing job creation for rural Utah. Our guests are Joel McKay-Smith. He is the co-founder and CEO of Accelerant BSP. We also have as our guest Ben Hart. He is the deputy director of the Governor's Office of Economic Development. So we're talking about the social costs. What about the retraining costs? Does the state have money that can help these families with retraining, or do they have to come out of pocket for that training?
No. If they're a displaced worker, the Department of Workforce Services has some tremendous programs that they can use. And I would say this, heavily underutilized programs as well. Not nearly as many people take advantage of that as they should. And so Department of Workforce Services can set you up with the right training institution and help get you reskilled. And we need to put a plug in for our training institutions across the state. Whether you're in Vernal, Duchesne, Price, we have some incredible rural training partners. But again, their programs are going underutilized because people don't know about them and people aren't taking advantage of them.
As an example, there's an initiative that's been in Kentucky for quite some time called Coal Miners Decoders that's been very successful. They've been able to convert actual equipment and automation officers into coders, and they're doing well in UI. There's a lot of thought processes within the pathways to be able to tie into the ATCs to start bringing a longer boot camp than the typical 13 weeks, maybe a 26-week boot camp that can tie into these same funds, custom fit, STIT, anything from the ATC, where they'll actually design and implement the curriculum if we can bring it into a position that there can be placement afterwards for the ROI for the agency.
Now, Joel, you've mentioned a couple times ATC. What is that and how does ATC tie into our conversation?
Applied Technology Center. It is adult education that is provided at the local level. I believe there's 8 of them over the course of the state, and they're amazing. Ethan down in Emory County, who's one of our commissioners as well. If we can come to him with the need for a training, in essence, you could think about a curriculum specific to a company. There might be something with Pluralsight as an example, where they need a curriculum for 30, and I'm not putting you up to this, Aaron, just so you know. There might be a need for 30 customer success agents that they have, and they know that they've got a fairly good match with a community to have those people with the soft skills that would work with that. We'd work with like an Ethan, and I can't ever say his name.
Migliori.
We could work with them to establish this curriculum for training this class. And they will take care of that. They will get them into the place ready. So when Pluralsight is ready to come into Castledale, Emory County, to have this customer success desk, they've got the fully trained curriculum taken care of for them. They have to take care of the compliance that's necessary, and they're ready to work. You just bring them up to Farmington, let them meet their new teammates, get them trained up, and then they'll work in a rural environment. There's great fiber down there to be able to do all of this.
So the fiber, I suspect, is the easy part.
It's the very easy part.
You mentioned it's already laid. The harder, we're talking about Pluralsight as an example, so let's just stay with that. You know, from a company standpoint, How do they then integrate in these teams from the rural area? How challenging is that for them?
Well, you know, and first, back to the fiber issue just quickly. It's something we take for granted in rural Utah. When we go back to national conferences, it's something that's not common. We are very well wired in the state of Utah, which I think is...
And how did that come to be?
Well, I think it's something we put a priority on. I think we've worked very well with our telecom providers. But I was down in Kanab and was meeting with a very sophisticated engineering firm that had decided to move their business to a second story of a Main Street building in Kanab.
12 draftsmen from San Francisco.
That's yeah, awesome. And the reason they did it was because they had the fiber there. It was laid, and they decided they wanted to work in Kanab instead of the Bay Area or San Diego or wherever it was. So, I mean, but the infrastructure is there. It's ready-made. There are opportunities for these companies to get people in. It's just, again, playing that connector, playing the convener.
You almost have to have somebody that's willing to take the plunge. Think of the lemmings jumping off the cliff. To a certain extent, we had that with health equity, but it's tough for them to take that plunge unless there's an assistance in de-risking the investment of taking that plunge. And that's something that's being worked on in many different fronts.
And so with the example of health equity, how did the state, how did organizations here in Utah help de-risk that opportunity for them?
The nexus of the relationship is Linda Gilmore, who is taking on your role at the Herbs, the Urban Rural Business Services, had been approached by a friend of Mike O'Malley's. I won't go into all the details. But they approached us if there might be something that we could do in the Association League of Governments incubator down in Price, Utah, to be able to fast-track a need that they had for some agents. And we fortunately had that, and we had done an assessment on the community, and we were able to ascertain that the necessary populace was there. So with them, it was a case of the advance work that Accelerant had done, the partnership with the Governor of Economic Development, and the willingness of Health Equity to look into this as an option. And because of all those things had been done from a private and public standpoint, we were able to do it quite nimbly. I think it was a total of 5 weeks from the first phone call to the first hire.
That's amazingly fast.
Well, it's all Joel's good work. I mean, they are doing incredible work. And, you know, when we see people who are willing to get different people together, parties together, to have these conversations, de-risk, understand, work together, I mean, then it becomes doable. But I think that people have just this natural barricade of, oh, I don't want to do that. It's too difficult. It's not worth it. And once we can get them through that, which Joel has proved very adept at in his company, I think we can make good things happen.
So, Joel, do you get funding from the state as well, or tell us more about your company?
We started on this journey in about 2014, and we're completely bootstrapped. It's all out of pocket with the proceeds coming in and the pocketbooks of the participants, and we're a pretty small group. Our growth, after the proof of concept of what we've done in Carbon County, is entirely based on a front-end social impact investment in a private-public business plan that we put together for our community, where we get letters of intent or letters of support from different companies that are willing to come into the community. We will buy or lease a facility, wire it up, get everything in place that's necessary, sit stand desks so it's very modular in the very co-working space, incubator, accelerator type based, and then we will take the plunge. We'll bring in the 20 or the 25 people. Generally, it takes about a 4-to-5 person ratio to hire type of a training that we'll do beforehand. If there is the necessity of higher training, it'd be a little bit longer curve. But then that's basically it. And then from the social impact accelerated investment into what we're doing, we do a debt finance model, and then the post performance that we can provide for the companies that have come into the community for different tax incentives that they can have. And I mean, tomorrow we're with EDA tomorrow talking about a possibility in Carbon County. And so that's not profiting. That's a case of actually being able to have an offset of what you do with a truly private-public relationship in a facility.
And, you know, there's nothing wrong with profiting, right? No. I mean, private companies need to make a profit in order for it to be interesting for them as well. You and I get together occasionally. We have a mutual friend, Bassam Salem, who's been a past guest on this show as well. He gets a group of guys together occasionally. We have wonderful conversations. I know from those you've been to Washington, D.C., the federal government is looking at your program. Yes. What would you like to see Accelerant grow into over the next 3, 5, 7 years?
I'd like to see Accelerant in Utah be a pilot for what we can have as an herbal remedy, which is urban, rural, working cooperatively to solve each other's problems. The SBA has been amazing. We're part of US Ignite in the Smart Gigabit Communities Initiative. And now we're also a seat at the table with the NC3, which is the National Coalition for Community Capital, which allows for local investing. It's an exception in the crowdfunding ruling for crowd investing. And we're one of the 15 states that doesn't have that yet. And working towards that, it allows for investment to stay local. I'd like us to be a model for what can be done in other states. We've been approached by about 19 other states to try to take the model of the cooperation with the companies forward. And we've politely declined because we realize that we need to make it work here because there's certain intricacies that are different from a state-by-state basis. But there's very, very acute interest in D.C. as to what they can see as the model that might work here and how it can be taken out into other states eventually.
And what got you interested in this space? Why focus on this space?
During the economic downturn of 2007 and 2008, my wife and I were both laid off over a 3 to 5 week period of time as everything was going down. So I'm kind of going, okay, do I go back into broadcasting, which I've done for years? Am I going to try to get a job? And my phone started ringing. People had lost their CIOs, their CTOs. I'm kind of a geek. And I started taking on consulting jobs. Besides the product that we launched in Bentonville, there was a phone call that came from this guy, Marion Timpson, who had landed a great big contract, but he didn't have any technology for his call center. And that came from Colorado City. And over a 2 to 3 week period, we were able to launch that successfully. It was through the group Cesare Direct that launched the GoPro and stuff like that. And I stayed with them for about 4 to 5 years. I still serve as an advisor. That's where it came from. I mean, come on. If all of the hot tenders that were out of work and the framers and everything else in Colorado City can get on a phone and answer infomercials or calls coming from, you know, Sky Mall that doesn't exist anymore and convert a cell and be making 20, 30 bucks an hour. If we can do it there, I mean, they're ultra rural and everything else. Look up 89. Look at what you can do out to UNA. The bona fide identification of the value prop that exists in rural Utah was completely clear.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense, and Utah's fortunate to have you focusing on this area. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more with Joel McKay-Smith. He is the co-founder and CEO of Accelerant BSP. We also have Ben Hart. He is the Deputy Director of the Governor's Office of Economic Development.
You're listening to The Bottom Line on KCPW. For podcasts and more local shows and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to The Bottom Line on KCPW. I'm Doug Wells. Today we're discussing job creation for rural Utah. My two guests are Joel McKay-Smith, co-founder and CEO of Accelerant BSP. Also, we have Ben Hart. He is the Deputy Director of the Governor's Office of Economic Development. So, Ben, before break, we were talking about several subjects. One of the topics that came up is the power of the broadband that we have in rural Utah. That's something that probably began a decade ago.
Yeah.
We're fortunate to have it in place today because of the foresight in the leadership folks had a decade ago. What types of things do we as a state need to be looking at coming in the next decade that we should be preparing for today?
Well, I love that question. That's what we've been thinking a lot about lately. I mean, there were a lot of people who made a lot of very bold at the time decisions, but doing things that ultimately really had tremendous payback for the state of Utah. And so I think what we're looking at now is what can we do to really make sure that we're just as forward-thinking and that we're really trying to develop, whether it's initiatives or programs, but we want to lay the infrastructure to ensure that 10 years down the road, we've made those same decisions now. So some of the things that we have to focus on and that we're very ingrained into right now are particularly things like policy discussions, programs. What programs do we have? this last legislative session, we saw probably four or five new programs created that are going to have a tremendous impact on rural Utah, whether it's the increase of the TRT tax to help fund some of the outdoor recreation projects, whether it's Senator Okerlund's Rural Jobs Act. We've had two or three, maybe even more than that, when you think about the high-cost infrastructure tax credit and other things that really can have a big impact on rural Utah. I think the question that we've got to answer, and it's the same thing with broadband, once you get it out there, what do you do with it? How do you make it effective? And I think that's what we've got to do with some of these programs that we've got. I think there's been a lot of discussion, particularly since the governor announced his 25,000 jobs in 4 years in his state of the state. There's been a lot of discussion around, what do we do? How does it look? What does this look like? Do we create a new program? And I think, though we've done that to a certain degree, we also have to look at implementation and effectiveness and the impact of those programs and how we can increase that. And I think that's what we're looking at now, is we have to be able to use the resources that are there, whether it's broadband, whether it's something like an enterprise zone that allows for certain types of tax credits, or whatever it is. We've got to make sure that those are effective and as utilized as they can be, or else we can design new programs, we can create new initiatives all day long, but if we don't use and aren't effective with what we've got, then ultimately we'll have failed.
Yeah, that's actually where I wanted to go next. Being part of the Governor's Office of Economic Development, there's all kinds of great ideas that people come up with. There's all kinds of interesting programs. Take us inside of the tent a little bit about how do you prioritize amongst the various alternatives and say, okay, here's the half dozen programs that can really move the needle.
Yeah, the inside of the tent here is interesting, to say the least. And it probably heats up most around the legislative session when everyone comes out of the woodwork with a new idea saying, this is what we can do. And ultimately, when we look at all of these different ideas that are presented to us, we have to really look at what's going to move the needle, what's outcome measurable, so that we know whether it's actually having an impact or not. There's a lot of ideas that just simply you can't measure that are goodwill. But then also, what do they cost, and what's the funding for them, and what's the local interface like? So we have to weigh those types of considerations, and we come up ultimately with, okay, here's our, you know, five top priorities. Here's our five top programs that we really want to push. And so Senator Okerlund's the Rural Jobs Act is definitely one of them. And then also the TRT tax with the outdoor recreation. But then using groups like Accelerant, how do we make sure that we're making those proper connections? That's going to be another priority and another initiative, this rural outsourcing concept that I think we're going to hear more about.
Yeah. So if companies are interested, they're they're listening to the show, they're hearing examples of health equity, they're hearing examples of Duncan Aviation, and they can see, hey, you know, we might benefit from having a workforce in rural Utah. What's the next step for a company like that?
Your timing's perfect. Number one, use the hashtag RUT25K. So that is Rural Utah, 25,000 jobs. We can have a unified social approach to what we're doing. It's still being planned, but on the 20th of June in the Founders Room at Zions Bank, and I'm sure it'll be distributed, the invitations through GOED, the World Trade Center Utah Group, as well as EDC Utah, we're planning on having kind of a kickoff meeting to have companies from the Wasatch Front come join us and see why they might want to come on one of the nine remaining tours. They've put together 10 tours that starts a week from today in Morgan County, that's going to hit 25 counties from mid-July through the early of September, finishing with Rural Days in Cedar City, Utah. I think it's the 7th or 8th of September.
Yeah, August. Yes.
And give us a plug. What would a CEO of a company see if he or she invested time to do that? What are some of the highlights that you think that they would come away from that program?
I think they're going to get information. I think they're going to get knowledge. And that's really what we need our CEOs to know about right now. What are the opportunities that are out there? What's available to them? I think that's going to be the most important thing. But I think being able to meet people like Joel, meet people that are in the governor's office, and being able to meet some of the conveners that can actually connect them with these opportunities, I mean, that's what we're hoping for. We know profits are strong right now. Now's an opportunity to give back as well. And so, but at the end of the day, these are dollars and cents decisions. They make sense. Mm-hmm. So
it's a time to give back. It's also a time to invest because times are good now. You want to be laying the foundation when things get challenging. If you're just joining us this morning, we're discussing job creation for rural Utah. Our guests are Joel McKay Smith. He is the co-founder and CEO of Accelerant BSP. We also have Ben Hart. He is the Deputy Director of the Governor's Office of Economic Development. You know, we've mentioned a couple times tourism, but we haven't really dug into that. What do you see going on in the tourism space?
Well, tourism is a very, very interesting concept right now. I think there are a lot of communities that are very familiar with it and thrive on it. I mean, we think of Moab, we think of other places in the southeastern part of the state, San Juan County, our national parks, etc.
In fact, our national parks are so it's hard to imagine that we can benefit from that many more visitors to the national parks.
Well, and you know, we'll take every visitor we can get. We know it's crowded, but that them coming in and making the investment in the state is big, and we appreciate it. But there are other communities where I think they want to coexist with tourism. And I think that's the balance that we're seeing right now. And we see this in a very public, high-profile way with the Bears Ears and other things related to the national monuments.
Now, the state of Utah also has a unique position that I think we might be the only state that has it. There might be Colorado might be one that has it as well, where it's this individual's job to promote tourism, where tourism right now is not a very big part of their economy. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it is interesting, and we do have our state office of tourism here. Vicky Varela does a tremendous job. In the local counties and the local parts of the state, though, some of them are more sophisticated, and I would say some of them don't want to put resources towards those types of employees or what have you. But I think ultimately, knowing what's there on the ground, knowing what each community wants and what we can do to help, that's really where we see our role. I mean, we don't want to force anything on any county, but we want to be responsive to ultimately what they want.
If I could interject here, one of the things that we're looking at is the seasonal aspect of the curve of the tourism with their peak seasons and their down seasons. If you think about the sharing economy and the ability to bring into these communities something else for those people to do besides following the snow or something like that in the form of providing during their down period something that may be call center oriented, it may be something that's manufacturing oriented, but something where you can have the inventory adjustment for where the time has the down cycles and the up cycles. That's something that with Accelerant, we'd love to be able to work with the counties and find a way to be able to keep those people occupied for the 3, 4, or 5 months that they may not have a way to be able to make an income.
Yeah, you know, originally when you were describing that, Joel, it sounded like a big tangent from what you're doing. Mm-hmm. But it's really about that technology, that call center service. And in this case, they'd be employees that are underutilized during certain seasons as opposed to a job switching.
Correct. And then making the adjustments necessary with that company to know that there can be a swell during that period of time. Healthcare industry is a perfect example. Open enrollments, about a 4 to 6 month window that anyone in the healthcare industry prepares for, and then they figure out what to do with that other 8 to 6 months of the year with those people's times because they don't want to retrain each time, so they have bonus time and everything like that. Something like that could be a very nice way to be able to accommodate the downtime, especially for the summer tourism industry.
Right. We've got to wrap up in a few minutes, but Joel, I want to go back to your revenue model, which, if I heard you right, relies in part on social impact investment funds supporting these programs. Are these Utah funds or are these funds throughout the country that are providing the capital?
I'd say that they're predominantly local funds, but think the Flyover State Initiative that Steve Case and J.D. Vance is working on right now. And we're not asking for a donation. We're asking for the ability to have the impetus monies necessary to start these centers. We can see this becoming relatively profitable within 12 to 18 months if we can get it at a capacity for these centers of over about 75%. So it's impact investment to get us started, debt financing to be able to keep it sustained, and then on the back end with what you can do with incentives that come back from the feds locally and from the state you can have an offset that makes it a much more profitable or sustainable for success model.
Oftentimes these impact fund investments are in the form of a loan that get paid back over a period of time. Like you said, you're not, I guess I'm asking you to talk more about, what do you mean when you say you're not looking for a donation?
It would be more of a line of credit, and the impact investors, they expect return. They want to be able to have the EIS, the economic impact statement that's necessary, the jobs that it's going to create. They're not going to loosen their purses unless they know that's there. It's typically in the form of a line of credit where they vouch for our ability to either put a note down on the building, either to lease or to buy, and then over time circle that into another community once the debt finance as well as the back-end incentives have been able to kick in.
Great. And Ben, I asked Joel earlier about what got him into this space and why he's focusing on it. I know the officers at GOED get recruited oftentimes. There's a fair amount of pressure. Typically, they come from the private sector. What were you doing before, and what was it about GOED that you found attractive?
Well, yeah, we do have a high turnover rate, and when it comes to the private sector, we have a high casualty rate as well. We have a lot of people who come into the office. We look at it as a term of service and then go back into the private sector. My personal track, I was at Zions Bank. I was in the private sector earlier in my career, and for me, I wanted that bigger impact on my community. And so I actually was in economic development up at Layton City before coming to the Department of Workforce Services. I think for me, that's what really opened my eyes was, you know, if you can provide economic opportunities and help somebody get the skill set that they need to be relevant, then you really are changing lives. That's hard to quantify in a private sector environment, particularly for me. So a few years ago, I got the call from Vince Micholet, my predecessor, great man at GOED. And he asked me to come over and to take his spot because he was going back into the private sector. You're right, you do get a lot of opportunities, people that will seek you out. But at the same time, you can't jump until you feel like your work's done. And I think this rural piece, we all feel like until we can get all 29 counties having the same success as what we see along the Wasatch Front, the work isn't done. And so we've got to be able to bring people together and come up with meaningful, again, as we've discussed today, solutions. But I think at the end of the day, I'm sure there'll be a private sector role for me in the future. But right now, I'm pretty content. I like what we're doing. We're in my other side of the house, in my other job, part of my job, I do corporate recruitment. So I've taken over for Teresa Foxley, who moved to EDC Utah. And that's fascinating. I mean, we've got so many businesses wanting to come into the state, so many projects that we're competing on. But where we really feel the difference is when we're out in the community and we meet someone who says, I work at that company. Or, you know, I am a contractor to that company, whatever it might be. And you know that you really are having an impact on the community.
It has to be incredibly rewarding. So coming from the banking community, now having been at GOED for a while, what do you wish that people knew about GOED and the efforts of the state of Utah that maybe the general public doesn't fully understand?
You know, it's fascinating. I studied economics and even to the master's degree level. And I think the role of government is something that's oft disputed in the state of Utah. And I think a lot of people just say, you know, fix my roads, pick up my garbage, whatever it is. Let's have government do what government does. But when you consider the economy is such a comprehensive, complicated beast, having people who are there on the front line to say, hey, we need to help manage certain aspects here. There are certain things we can do to help shape economic forces in the state of Utah. And people don't see that every day. They see the very visible optical part of government, parts of government, but they experience what we do when they have good places to work and when we see good economic multipliers into other industries. I mean, that's where GOED is so valuable. Having an agency that has their fingers on the pulse and is visibly, actively trying to help shape what our economy is doing is invaluable.
Well, it seems to me as an outsider that we get a tremendous multiple for every dollar that we put into programs like we're talking about today. And I'm glad the state of Utah recognizes it. So we're going to have to wrap up on that note. Thank you both for joining us today on The Bottom Line.
Pleasure. Thank you very much.
Our guests this morning have been Joel McKay Smith. He is the co-founder and CEO of Accelerant BSP, and Ben Hart. He is the deputy director of the Governor's Office for Economic Development. Today's show was recorded at the KCPW studios on Library Square and produced by Ross Chambliss. Thank you, Ross. You can hear our entire conversation on our website, kcpw.org, or on the Bottom Line podcast. You can tweet me, nicely please, at Savvy Wells or at KCPW Bottom Line. I'm Doug Wells. Join us next week on The Bottom Line.